Welcome to Pundit Celebrity Deathmatch. In the purple corner, weighing in at 100 pounds, wearing the big red fez, hailing from Irvington, New York, Seth Small is the new big Golden. And in the red corner, weighing in at an unimpressive 200 pounds plus, it's the 32nd Grim Reaper from the Burbs, Joseph the Juice Man, Jeffy. And now, ladies and gentlemen, let's get ready to prognosticate!
For Connecticut, bringing you the juice. It's Across the Sound, the new marketing podcast. With your host, Joseph Jaffe. You've just entered the no bullshit zone.
Well, it's ATS 47, and here we are, surrounded by a cage. I think this is the Thunderdome, in fact. There are maybe 100,000 people, if I look really, really carefully. A lot of them are salivating. It seems that they might be a little bit rabid, but there's definitely a lot of blood, or at least cries for blood. Actually, we're in the food court at the Westchester Mall. And I'm here with none other than Seth Godin. Seth, welcome, a huge, huge welcome to Across the Sound.
Well, it's great to be here, and I'm delighted that the Cajun Burgers are on you today.
You know, it's a very interesting story in terms of how Seth came to be on the show. It started off with a conversation with David Omono, and I said to David, you will never, ever guess who's going to be on Across the Sound. The first thing he said was Seth Godin, and I said, actually, it's Corbin Burnson from LA Law. But interesting idea. I said, hang on 1 second, and I emailed Seth, and I said, hey, it would be awesome if you'd come on the show. And while I'm still literally, I think, Skyping David or IMing him, Seth agreed without pretty much any conditions. He didn't even hesitate, and I'm very excited because, obviously, you know, I followed Seth for a long, long time. He was one of the first people that I reached out to ask for advice about publishing my book, my first book. And no doubt there's going to be a lot of interesting stuff we're going to talk about today. Before we get into it, I wanted to thank Dan Gorgone. Apparently his last name rhymes with pawbone. I didn't know that was a word. I'll go to Wikipedia. He's a web designer and a media producer for a research company by day. At night, he wears underpants over his pants, apparently. He's an actor and a podcaster in his free time. The reason I'm thanking him is he produced the little celebrity Seth Match vignette that you heard to introduce the show. And I just wanted to thank him. And if you want to find out more about his web design work, go to dangorgone.com. And his acting gigs can be found at dangorgone.com/actor. And, of course, I'm going to make sure that I provide those links in the show notes. So what we're going to do today, basically, we have four questions that have come in. And we're going to play those questions and we're going to respond to them. Seth and I are going to talk about a couple of things that are on our minds. And then, of course, we're going to get into winners and losers. The first thing I wanted to do is actually talk a little bit to Seth about his upcoming book, Small is the New Big. I immediately thought about it, and it meant something to me. I've spoken about this on Across the Sound before. The managing director of Nando's Chickenland in South Africa used to say the smallest things or the cheapest things are the most important things. I wonder what Seth thinks about that, but most importantly, I want to hear a little bit about the book. So I'll hand the microphone to him and let him tell you a little bit about it himself.
Thank you, Joseph. It's great to be here, even if we're in the Westchester, and nice to appear on your podcast. The new book called Small is the New Big, you can find it at www.smallis.com, is a collection of 7 years worth of writing from Fast Company and my blog. And the reason it's a book is not for the people who are listening to this podcast, because most of the people who are listening have read some of the stuff I've written, or else they're not interested. But either way, they don't necessarily need a book that reprints it. The reason it's a book is because you have lots of people you work with or who work for you or clients who need to catch up, who have been sort of ignoring a lot of the shifts and changes that we've been living with for the last 7 years. And after I posted my 1,000th blog post after 5 years of doing it, I looked at that and I said, this stuff's all too ephemeral. It's not an easy place to find. It's hard to page through and it's not organized. So I sat down and pulled together the best stuff. And the goal is to set off fireworks that I believe that my readers and people who haven't read my stuff yet have great ideas inside of them, have the motivation they need to accomplish stuff. But it's stuck. And my job is to tell a short story or make up a word or give us a longer example that somehow causes things to combust, that gets people to do the thing they needed to do all along anyway. And that's what the book is. It's one of the longest books I've done, but the longest piece in it is no more than 10 pages long. So it's sort of like eating popcorn. You can take a little bit or a lot. And so far I'm getting pretty good feedback about it.
So by small, we'd be referring to the actual posts and the fact that ideas can be communicated quite succinctly but have rather large impact?
Well, let me talk about what's in the book. The title essay, Small is the New Big, is one of the most popular blog posts I ever posted. And what it said was that the marketing rules have changed so fundamentally that this is not about how can you get a commercial on YouTube. What the world has become is a world where acting small gets you big. That all the attributes of a successful small company, the attention to detail, the willingness to work with individuals, the ability to be authentic, the fact that you don't have policies, the fact that you're willing to interact with the world as the world comes to you are the things that the market now demands. So in the old days, big was how you succeeded. Big was an efficient factory. Big was a big ad budget. But what my Small is the New Big riff says is that all those things are now disabilities. They're disadvantages. And that what wins today is thinking small, even if you're big. So that essay is the cornerstone of the entire work, because if the book is about anything, it's about the fact that there's more potential, more upside, more opportunities today than ever before, but only for people who are willing to think small. That when the Fortune 500 companies do their studies and try to figure out how to get in a big way, they always do the wrong thing.
We're actually very close to the Apple store. And I think Apple, I've given them quite a tough time, maybe because I think they deserve to be challenged. And they're certainly such a creative and innovative brand and certainly loved by so many people. I don't believe this company and this brand acts small in any way at all. And I think they've demonstrated, they only seem to demonstrate bigness in the form of being detached, aloof, and quite arrogant as well. I'm curious as to what you think about Apple as a brand in terms of how they act. And maybe a different question would be, who do you think, which company, which brand or brands do you think does a particularly good job at demonstrating smallness, even though they might in fact be big?
I think we have to resist fundamentalist orthodoxy. I think that Apple does several things that are very, very small. The smallest thing they do is one guy whose name we know makes up stuff. One guy decides. One guy, not a committee, decides to get into a business, decides to change a product, decides something isn't cool enough. And so, you know, Keynote exists because one guy decided he hated PowerPoint. That's small. That's a small way to think. Dell acted big. Dell has a committee for everything. Dell has to make sure that it fits the middle of the market. And so, yeah, Apple does things that are arrogant. There's no question about it. And Apple annoys people. But it's also true that thinking small is exactly what made the iPod work. And if Apple had done focus groups, and if Apple had asked people's opinion, and if Apple had taken the you know, consumer feedback, we wouldn't have the iPod, and it certainly wouldn't be what it is today. That there's a problem with, you know, we have a vacuum here, which is that old marketing, which was filled with orthodoxy, went away. That, you know, we're sitting here in a mall, and if we look at each one of these fast food restaurants, we could change the signs, and we couldn't tell. They're all the same. They all have the same clear doors on the fridge. They all have the same vinyl signs hanging in the background. They all have the same, because orthodoxy is easy to adopt. And one of the things I reject on the web is when someone says it has to be a certain way, right? Steve Jobs has to have an email address and write back to anyone who writes to him. No, he doesn't. That part of what is acting small is about is being an iconoclast. That what we're seeing is that in the marketplace, whether you are selling a brand of cosmetics or a consulting practice or, you know, the way you find oil for an oil company, iconoclasts have a better chance than ever to stand out. So I don't want to dwell on Apple because they're such a special case. None of us could be Apple. But I think it's not fair to say that Apple is big, 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 because they're not.
And Seth, how about an example of one company or brand besides them as the exception that you think does a particularly good job at demonstrating that smallness?
Well, you know, you often notice it when it's not there. I went to a Starbucks yesterday, and there was an 18-year-old behind the counter who was hot because their air conditioning was broken. He was angry, and he was ready to get fired. And he was bad-mouthing customers, and he was just being a low-level fast food jerk, which we see every day at every other restaurant, but I had never once seen in a Starbucks. And what's fascinating about Starbucks is those aren't franchises. Those are owned by Starbucks. There's five levels between Howard Schultz and that guy. And yet, the store managers are so carefully selected and trained that every store, in my experience, at some level acts small. That the person behind the counter often acts like it's their Starbucks, not like they're just punching a clock. And so I think that's a really interesting example of how a company almost as big as McDonald's, almost as big as Burger King, acts like neither of them. No policies, no real rules. If you want, you know, ice in your coffee, they'll put it in there. They don't charge you extra because the person says, sure, fine. There isn't a thing like if you ask for a cup, they have to charge you for it. Because the whole mindset is, let's act small at this moment. They act big when they do a real estate deal. They act big when they do a movie deal. But they act small in that moment when it really matters.
Okay, it all comes back, and I'll go back to the Nando's example, and I'm sure I've mentioned this in previous episodes of Across the Sound. There was a Portuguese guy by the name of Vasco, and he operated the Seapoint Nando's store. And he's probably one of the main reasons why I started working for them, because I spent so much time and money and just used to eventually hang around in his store, just chat to him. We'd go drinking and, you know, we did, and we became friends. He always made sure, you know, to my detriment, that my chicken burgers were overflowing with offcuts and whatever the case may be. But he knew every single person literally by face, by name. The most amazing thing happened once a year. He took a week's vacation. And during that week, every single year, complaints soared tenfold. It was all completely perceptual because nothing changed except for the fact that familiarity, you know, wasn't there. And one of the things we as marketing would do, in fact, I would do when I trained the franchisees, is I would go in and I'd say, my words were actually, marketing doesn't know shit. You know, and then of course they'd all cheer because, you know, they hated marketing. You know, marketing and the people who work there. And I'd say, look, we sit in our ivory tower and we do our best to understand the consumer and we come up with all these ads and these, you know, these sometimes pretty cool campaigns. But at the end of the day, if you've had a bad day, if you're not smiling, you know, if you forget your consumer's name, if you snarl at them because you had a fight with your boyfriend or girlfriend the night before, that's the Nando's experience. Period. That's the magic. And everything else means jack squat. You know, if you don't activate, if you don't ignite that moment of truth. And I think that's another example of smallness. You know, the thing that I was writing down a few notes as you were talking, and I wrote down two things. Think different, act fast. In addition to thinking small, but you also spoke about speed, and I thought about, well, Steve Jobs, you know, the man who was nameless, you know. He wants to do something, he does it. There's no decision by committee. The Boston Red Sox tried it, it failed. Decision by committee doesn't work. And it's funny because the one thing that you do, Seth, is, you know, and I read your blog regularly, is many of your posts are just reflections of life. As you walk around, you can spend a day in the Westchester Mall and fill up your blog for a month, in a sense. Just today, you were telling me about, well, I'll let you tell the story about what you saw as you walked in. Here's my story. I walked into Tourneau this morning, and a watch that my wife got when we got married 7 years ago has stopped working and it needs a new battery. But the fact that it was bought at Tourneau, they're going to go ahead and change it, no questions asked. The service aspect is great, but that's not what I wanted to talk about. What they told me is that in my watch, which is it's a Cartier and it's an automatic watch, if you stop wearing it for 48 hours, it's basically going to shut down. It basically feeds on movement. And to me, it's fascinating, you know, how we put a man on the moon is less fascinating than to me than the fact that my watch works because I work. And just my life and my movement is enough to keep my watch, which is an extension of me, going. So that was my reflection being in the Westchester Mall. Why don't you just quickly talk about what you saw this morning? Because I thought that was quite fascinating.
Well, you know, I think that there's way too much reliance on facts and figures and data and proof. Those are fine when all other things are equal, but all other things are almost never equal. That what people, consumers, business people buy is a story. We buy the stuff we need because we need it, but there's very little few things that are on that list, food and shelter. The things we want because of the way they make us feel. And so, yeah, my blog is about stories and about real life, because reminding marketers and business people about these little episodes is so critical, because otherwise we'd spend all our time with a spreadsheet, and that's a mistake. So we were talking as we walked in. I almost got injured this morning because 20 women with babies in strollers were running around the mall in a pack, exercising. And there's a woman who makes a living running this class. They pay her money and they follow her around the mall. Well, the first thing I notice is obviously the mall could shut her down, but they don't want to, because the minute the class is over, these women go and buy themselves a treat, a reward, because they've been in the mall, they're familiar. And what malls have become, and I'm not the first person to say this, is sort of the new piazza, the new meeting place, especially when it's 105 degrees outside. And that's another fundamental shift in the way people are acting online and offline. We have new centers, new places we interact with each other, and along the way, people charge a fee. You don't have to pay money to get into the mall, but the souvenirs of your trip, the Lacoste shirt or the frozen yogurt cone, that is where they make their profit.
And, you know, it's an experience as well, and they've been able to activate coming to the mall, spending time in the mall, based on a very simple premise, which is the more time people spend in the mall, the more likely they'll be to buy in the mall. So that was kind of an interesting observation as well. On my way, and I want to talk to Seth about innovation, and we have a question. Actually, we have four questions, and we'll play those in a moment. Seth has always been, I think, on the cutting edge, or I guess I used to hear about leading edge, and now I hear about bleeding edge, and that's an interesting idea of that blood sometimes has to be drawn if you're so close to the edge, which I would imagine is quite sharp. But Seth has always been able to talk to marketers and challenge them and sometimes kind of rebuke them in terms of their slowness or their inability to adopt and embrace change. I was driving in this morning, and I heard that Foster's, Australian for beer, of course, we all know the commercials. Yes, the 30-second spot commercials. Foster's has made a decision to cut television completely. U.S., this is a U.S. decision. They're cutting television completely out of their media plan in favor of online. According to CBS Radio, it was online websites. I'm not sure whether we're talking about banners and buttons, whether we're talking about search, whether we're talking about video, whether we're talking about social media or just mini sites. But the bottom line is television is gone. And it occurred to me that Foster's is now Australian for life after the 30-second spot. The reality is that everybody knows it, everybody's aware of it, everybody remembers the ads. Clearly, not many people or not enough people were buying beer. And I guess, you know, my question to Seth, or to throw it back to him, is talk a little bit about what's changed in the past 5 to 10. I mean, everything has changed in the past 10 years with the mainstreaming of the web and now this Web 2.0 or however you want to talk about it. What are you seeing in terms of, from the marketing standpoint, a marketing side, in terms of, are they getting it, in terms of adoption, in terms of mainstreaming? You know, what is happening, what isn't happening, what has surprised you and impressed you, and what still frustrates you in terms of marketers and agencies' ability to move at the pace or the rate of change and the pace or the rate of consumers?
Well, I think it starts with the fact that almost everybody I talk to as an individual wants to be remarkable, wants to innovate, wants to make changes. And that as soon as 2 or 3 people get in the room, the tone changes. Because more than they want to do that, they want to avoid getting in trouble. And for a long time, the impulse to avoid getting in trouble was a good one to listen to. That in 1964, changing your TV campaign was a mistake. That the longer you kept it, the better it did. And so there's a long time corporate culture and organizational culture and nonprofit culture and political culture that says, keep your head down, groupthink, let's make sure it's safe. But now there's a different game. And the game is that there are 2 competitors sitting across each other from a table, and there's 1 marshmallow in the middle of the table. And it's like draw in the old Westerns. The first person to get the marshmallow gets it. Well, if your mindset is to wait, to be safe, to be sure it's okay, you're never going to get the marshmallow. The other guy's always going to get it. And what we've seen is both online companies like Yahoo and stuff, but also offline companies that try an innovation, going first with the right story to the right people pays huge dividends. And going third pays almost nothing. And so if you're going to take the Microsoft mindset and say we're going to wait till version 3.0, we're going to work it through the system, we're going to polish it, you're going to always be behind now. And that mantra for Microsoft stopped working a couple years ago. And it's not just tech stuff. It's also fashion stuff. It's clothing stuff. It's music stuff. So the companies that said, you know, we don't really want to get in rap. Rap is unproven. The companies that said, we don't really want to play ball with the iTunes store. It's unproven. The Hollywood studios who say, we got to keep making $200 million movies because this whole indie mindset is unproven. That's all a mistake. And you now get punished. And so my mantra of safe is risky is more true than it ever was. The safer it feels, the riskier it is. And the opposite is true. There are many, many things in life now in marketing where if it feels risky, you got to do it. Because if it feels risky to you, it's risky to your competition. That means you get to go first. If you can cut your downsides and tell the right story to the right people, your upsides are terrific.
You know, it's funny. As you were saying that, I wrote down a quote which is very similar. Safe advertising is the riskiest advertising you can do. That was said by Bill Birnbach 50 years ago. And so Seth said, got to steal from good people. Well, I mean, it's a different, but the idea is here you have Bill Birnbach 50 years ago when arguably television was at its prime. I mean, absolutely rich, robust, you know, the gullible American populace ate it all up for breakfast. They believed that whites were whiter and brights were brighter. And if 7 out of 6 doctors agreed, then therefore that was the choice. And now, of course, consumers are so skeptical and smarter, and the wisdom of crowds mentality sets in. And yet, here's a guy 50 years ago that in a way, you know, if he were alive today, he'd be a very, very frustrated and impatient man. So it's interesting to see that the writing was on the wall 50 years ago and nobody bothered to actually look up and read it. It's quite sad, but yet I guess fortune will favor those that take chances and risks, and we certainly will talk about that in our winner and loser, won't we?
Yeah, I just want to disagree maybe a little bit. I don't think consumers are a lot smarter at all. consumers are driving Hummers. Consumers are running their air conditioning at 68 degrees. Consumers are busy making short-term decisions. Consumers are still smoking cigarettes. Consumers are buying bottled water. Consumers do lots of things that aren't smart. What I think is consumers are more sophisticated. Consumers are pickier about the stories they choose to believe. Whether or not those stories are good for them, they still believe them. And so what marketers need to do is take a different sort of risk. It's a story risk, a risk that feels uncomfortable to them but is critical.
I mean, I'll give you that. The one thing that I say is that I don't think consumers are empowered. I just think we've become powerless, and it's a relative empowerment. But I think that point is taken. Consumers are, at the end of the day, you know, whether we believe they're smart or not, or smarter than us or not, or smarter than they used to be 50 years ago, you know, the fact is consumers are human. They are fallible. They do make mistakes. But I think that the smartness, I do think that that smartness is a relative smartness as well. It'll be interesting to see what happens. And I think, you know, you are reminding me that at the end of the day, even I, for example, I talk about consumers not being powered, but yet I say consumers are smarter. I think they're smarter than we give them credit for. That I will say. But yeah, let's move to some of the questions, and we're going to start off with Chris Herbert. By the way, here's one thing I want to say completely just as a tangent. The four questions we did get in are all from people that have commented on Across the Sound before. It was interesting to me that no first time commenters actually stepped up to the plate, and it does come back to something that I do believe, which is once you've done it, you're a lot more likely to do it again and again and again. And it's a little bit addictive, actually, you know, speaking up and hearing your voice and enjoying that recognition of hearing your voice and realizing, wait a second, I can actually not just hear my own voice, but I can actually get answered. My burning questions can be answered. So, you know, Chris, Michael, David, and Peter, appreciate the fact that you guys contributed to the show, but to the others, plus 1-206-203-3255. The comment line is open and always waiting for your comments. So let's start off with Chris Herbert.
Hey, Joseph. It's Chris Herbert calling. It's the first time I'm actually using Skype to record a voice message or an audio comment. So this is a bit of an experiment for me, so bear with me. I have a question for your podcast with Seth Godin. I look at both of you guys as thought leaders in the marketing space, and I think it's a great thing that the two of you are getting together to chat about your differences as well as some of the things that you see eye to eye on. So my question to you both is basically, where do you see the sales function evolving over the next 3 to 5 years with the immersion of consumer-generated media and conversation-based marketing? I wonder where the traditional B2B sales role will fit into that. I mean, account managers are never going to go away. They are valuable in terms of building relationships with customers and uncovering sales opportunities and closing deals. But I'm curious as to what you guys think their role will be in the future. So I'll sit back and listen to your response. And keep up the great work, both of you. And never give up and continue to provide listeners like us with great opportunities to learn and be educated, as well as to contribute to the conversation. All the best.
Well, I just got to tell you, I'm going to let Seth take this one first. But if you could just see us right now, I mean, all we need is someone with a camera phone and a Flickr account. We've both got our ears peeled to my Dell computer. It actually looks quite comical. But anyway, so the question's really about the sales function, and I think we've certainly seen what Google has done to B2B magazines. But from a B2B standpoint, even just a sales standpoint in general, what does the future look like? So I'll let Seth open that one up.
Thank you for your question. I want to start by clarifying one thing. I do not believe that marketing is a conversation. I think that markets are conversations, but there's a really big difference. Marketing and selling as an extension of that is about storytelling. And storytelling for 10,000 years, as Carl Jung, has been about one person telling a story. That story, if it's successful, leads to a conversation. It leads to people talking to each other and that story entering the mainstream. The role of selling is to cause people who didn't get the story to get it. It's to cause the story to lead to the conversation. That a sale, you know, sometimes you read a sales book that says all you should do when you walk in is ask 20 questions, get the answers to those questions, and somehow use that to persuade the person to buy from you. I don't think that's the way it works. I think the moment you call on the phone, the moment you show up, you're already telling a story. You're telling a story in the way you're dressed, in the way you approach things, and what brochure you pull out, and the name of your company, the reputation of your company, and now you have a chance, human to human, which we evolved to really value, human to human, to tell a story, an authentic story, a story that matches my worldview, a story that I want to believe. And if that story is effective, it'll lead to a conversation, and that conversation is what a marketplace is all about. That conversation can lead to ideas spreading. So do I think a sales force is important, especially in a B2B context? Absolutely. Do I think that most salespeople are up for it? Absolutely not. I think that most salespeople get stuck in taking orders, meeting their numbers, figuring out how to make quota. Most salespeople are cherry-picking exactly the wrong customers, and that companies that take a bigger view of the world, that are willing to take their time and put the right story in front of the right person in the right way and then amplify it, those companies do great in the long run and eventually in the short run. So I think, and I've written about this, that selling's not dead at all. But if all you're doing is taking an order, a computer can take an order way better than you can.
And, I'm absolutely going to agree and talk about the human aspect. Where I disagree slightly is, and we'll go to the markets as conversations, it's not that marketing is a conversation. I think marketing is part of a conversation. I have a three-tiered kind of structure, which is communication, conversation, and transformation. And I think the problem with marketing is that it has been too communication-based or biased. It has been, and communication I define as one way. Communication is something that is initiated by the sender, by the marketer, by the seller, on their terms, as opposed to the recipient or the buyer's terms. So that I wanted to just kind of make that point. But I absolutely agree as well. Nothing, I don't believe, will take the place of that human interaction. And the word I'm going to use, not so much the story, but I'm just going to emphasize relationship. And I'm going to emphasize a point that I think I made last week. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Nobody wants to talk to a salesperson ever unless they actually want to talk to a salesperson. You know, I mean, the fact is I've been called on and called upon by so many sellers. If they happen to call on me when I'm just in that mood to buy, terrific. But most of the time, it's about being in that consideration set. It's about being able to establish that rapport, that dialogue, that connection. And there is a story there. There is absolutely no doubt. So thank you, Chris, for that comment.
Hi, Seth. Hi, Joseph. It's Michael Seaton from Toronto, Canada, the client side guy. And I was wondering, Seth, what one thing, be it a piece of technology, an idea, an innovation, have you seen or heard of in the past year that you believe is going to change marketing forever, and why? That's my question. I hope to hear it answered. Thanks, guys, and take care.
Thanks, Mike. I'll take this one first. You know, I'm troubled by the fact that that every day that goes by, I honestly believe that consumers are growing advertising by the day. And the one idea or innovation or technology that I am most interested in right now is RFID, is point of sale and GPS and RFID all kind of mashed up together. It really comes down to being in that store. You know, in this day and age of Walmart Nation, of these superstores, etc., a billion SKUs. I mean, the average supermarket right now with 40,000 SKUs. I just think a lot of the magic and a lot of the moments of truth are going to happen in that store. And I've seen some signs, some glimpses in terms of what that future might look like, and where the shopping cart is going to become, you know, tomorrow's shopping cart will be the equivalent of yesterday's boob tube. So RFID would be the one thing that I think right now, and I'm talking about RFID. I'm really talking about point of sale and RFID, but it's the ability for that networked communication to start occurring in store, whether it's between consumer and manufacturers, whether it's between products, whether it's between consumer and products, whether it's between different consumers that are actually in the store at the same time, being able to exchange ideas, recipes, whatever. That's something that's definitely got my interest.
Thank you for the question. 8.5 years ago, Don Peppers and Martha Rogers wrote a book that everybody listening to this needs to go read called The One-to-One Future. And what it predicted and what it was right about, and something I was happy to steal a lot of ideas from, is the idea that not only is the mass market dying fast, but we're getting to a market segmentation of one. But the web changed that a lot, because not only is it a market segmentation, but that's the wrong way to look at it, because that's a top-down approach. What we have now is easily identifiable consumers, and RFID is part of this. But the fact is that any individual that wants to stand up and say something, be counted, have an opinion, or have an interaction, can, and they can do it in a way that leaves a trail. And this is especially true in the business-to-business world, but now it's moving into the consumer world. So the fascinating future is the juxtaposition between idea viruses and viral marketing and word of mouth and ideas that spread, which involve groups, and individuals. Individuals who are sure they're right until they change their mind, and then they're right again. And so advertising is not going to go away, because capitalism requires companies to have the ability to spend money to grow. So they're going to figure out a way to spend money to grow. They're going to cheat. They're going to lie. They're going to steal. They're going to do whatever is necessary to break systems. But at the same time, consumers have this power they don't even realize, which is voting with their pocketbook, voting with their blog posts, voting with their telephone, voting with their feet. And now each individual can be tracked. And what you're going to discover is the bananas end up next to the milk at Walmart. And the reason is because people who buy bananas buy milk, and Walmart knows it. That wasn't true 20 years ago. That's a technological breakthrough, but it's also a shift in our culture, because we're all spoiled brats and we're all far more demanding than we ever were before.
It's interesting you spoke about trail, and I've heard the idea of residue as well, and we think about it in the CSI culture today. It's a meme, maybe, or the beginnings of a meme that's definitely picking up and gaining momentum, which is this idea I just jotted down on a piece of paper. Seth was here, as in W-U-Z, and here, H-E-E-R, Seth was here. But I think that's the point, is that we aren't ships passing in the night anymore. Seth's doing a little doodle, which I'll see if I can... Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's Kilroy. And the whole idea, but I just looked at the bald head. So the idea is that consumers are leaving these trails, and it's the smart marketers that are picking up on these trails and figuring out how to connect the dots. So thank you, Michael. We're going to go to Peter Stevenson all the way down under in Australia. I wonder what Peter thinks about Foster's decision.
Hi, Joseph. It's Peter Stevenson calling from On Communications down under in Sydney. Just got a quick question for the God and Jaffe Brains Trust session. Mate, we all know that people these days are increasingly controlling their media interaction, and as a result, therefore, the marketing interaction on their own terms. I suppose really what I'm sensing is that we're going to have a new set of, or new rules of engagement, if you like, for marketers, where they're going to need to create campaigns that are different, that capture people's imagination, either with big ideas or find ways to connect and engage with them on a different level. What I really wanted to get your perspective on from you guys is, do you really see that we're entering a time now where brands will, in essence, have to sort of, I suppose, earn the right to market and to communicate to people? And what are the ramifications of this consumer control on marketing in the future? Thanks, guys. See ya. Look forward to hearing the answers. Bye.
Thanks, Peter. So, Seth, you want to kick this one off?
Sure. This is what I wrote about in Purple Cow. It's already 3 years ago. You know, if mass marketing is dead and you need to grow, then what's your choice? Well, your board of directors is not going to accept the fact that you're going to get your commercials on YouTube, because you can't predict that and there's no way to scale it. So where does the future lie? I think the future lies in the experience, the product, the innovation, making stuff that's remarkable, things that are worth talking about. It also involves dramatically cutting down your overhead that's associated with cranking out average stuff for average people and then promoting it all day long. So, you know, Kmart is in a disastrous situation because no one reads the freestanding insert. No one is going to go out of their way to go to a Kmart when a Walmart might be a nickel cheaper. And as a result, Kmart can't thrive selling average stuff to average people. And you go down the street to Target, and people go to Target because they buy something that they can talk about, which brings new customers who buy something that they can talk about. So the new mantra is not, what are the rules of engagement for interrupting consumers who don't want to hear from you? The question is, what are the rules of engagement for making stuff that businesses and consumers want to buy because they want to talk about it?
You know, I would add one of the things I often say to marketers is that the first thing they should do when they leave the room is go to their brand guideline, you know, 17-chaptered Bible and burn it. Because the fact is consumers don't care about Pantone 172 versus 168. Consumers are colorblind. I think the biggest, maybe one of the most difficult things for marketers to come to terms with is that the past 50 years of brand building and brand equity means actually nothing to consumers today that are living in the moment and that are living for now and are living for the future. And so, yeah, the rules are completely different. And I do believe that brands need to earn, you know, Seth, you spoke about permission marketing all the way back when. Permission hasn't, I don't think it has never been more important than it is right now in terms of brands fitting into our lives as opposed to the other way around. And it's not that brands will die unless they kind of adopt a whole new set of rules. But the ones that do, I think, are going to do better or have a better chance at being able to differentiate themselves, stand out from the crowd, and be able to surge forward at the expense of the lethargic, complacent, mediocre storytellers, you know, and offers out there that are in search of a need to either be created falsely and contrived fashion or to be filled. So thank you for that, Peter. All right, the final one is from David Armano, and I'll play it right now.
Hi, Joseph. This is David Armano from Logic and Emotion. A question for Seth. In regards to the whole comments and no comments and all that good stuff. So, Seth, my question for you is, when you responded with your official statement on your blog, one thing I noticed is that it came across as, in some ways, a bit non-authentic and compared to some later discussions that I had seen you having. Specifically, you had gotten to some discussion with Matt Collier on another blog where you had just made it much more personal. I think you had referenced, you know, just maybe the comments have something to do with your high school experiences. It just seemed more personal. And I was just wondering if you saw that the same way in terms of your first initial response and maybe some of the ways that you had responded afterwards. That was really it. I just, for me, felt that some of your later responses were just made you seem more like a person, and I related to them a lot more in contrast to your initial response. So I didn't know if you had a take on that.
All right, Seth. Well, I guess you better respond to this one.
Thanks, David. You know, as I said before, but I want to say it really clearly, I apologize. I apologize because there are several hundred people, well-meaning, intelligent, smart, connected people who want to have a platform on my blog to comment, and I understand that. And I didn't mean to offend those people, and if I did, I'm sorry. You know, I think we have to differentiate that feeling of, I don't know, being shut out from having a platform from getting fundamentalist about what is a blog and what isn't a blog and whether feedback is being given or not. I think that I'm pretty high up there in the feedback category. I get real emails every day from real people, and I write back all the time. My problem with comments is the anonymous ones, the spam ones, the evil ones, the ones that are designed to provoke as opposed to inform. And I just don't want to spend the time or the emotion to curate that platform. And my vision of the world is that blogs are easy to build and blogs are non-anonymous, and blogs are a good way to connect your thread, your point of view. And some people on their blog want other people to comment, and I say more power to them. I have no problem with that. I don't comment very often on other people's blogs, but I read them all the time. And I email people all the time, and when people email me, I write back. I've gotten great ideas from people who interacted with me, and I'm all for it. I think that that level of interaction with these passionate pro-am people is one of the best things I get out of the Internet. It's something that propels my work every day. And all I can do is apologize to the people I offended and beg them to understand that Boing Boing doesn't have comments, Post Secret doesn't have comments, I don't have comments, and lots of other blogs don't. I hope they can forgive me, and if they can't, well, then we're just going to have to agree to disagree. So thank you for the question, and that's my best answer for you.
And you know what the thing is that whether the conversation continued and ensued, and you were part of the conversation, and everyone, I think, has moved on. And I don't, it's funny, you talk about apologizing. I don't even know that that is even necessary. I think, if anything, people read your blog with more passion now. I know one of my clients, actually, at Coke, even posted to my blog and actually said, once again, Seth has demonstrated his ability to be one step ahead and understand, you know, and basically inspire or catalyze a conversation without actually being a part of it. So it was kind of interesting. A couple of other just random thoughts. I think it was either on 4Media Release or maybe Daily Source Code. A new Pew study, I believe, came out on the blogosphere. What's also interesting is the rise of anonymous blogs. So forget about anonymous comments. It's the anonymous blogs now. There is that very malicious PR blog called Strumpet. So there is a lot of, you know, the fears that you have are happening on a much grander scale as well. The other thing that is apparent to me is the lack of context and the ambiguity that appears in a text format. It's one of the, I asked Seth earlier if he was thinking of podcasting, and he said no. But what I love about podcasting is I think you get a sense of context in hearing my voice and hearing the lilt or the intonation or really what I really think. I just, me personally, I hate text. I hate email. I've lost the battle. I've just given up on it. In fact, if you ever send me an email and you don't get a response in 10 minutes, you won't get a response from me. Send it again and again and again. I give you permission to keep on sending me email until I tell you no, or I got it, or I'll get back to you, whatever the case may be. I bumped into Brian Eisenberg, who I'd never met before, and he's a terrific, terrific guy. And he sang, you know, and he's got a mediocre singing voice, Seth's praises, and he said Seth is one of the most responsive, personable guys. He demonstrated that to me. Whenever I've emailed him, I don't know how he does it, but within 60 seconds basically he gets back to me. So that was another thought. But the most important thought in this, and it's a segue to one item that we'll discuss, and then we'll get into winners and losers and keep this well under 60 minutes, is this idea of caring. You know, I posted about Crocs and this idea of, you know, hatred, embrace hatred. And I don't mean hatred as in, you know, hate. I'm talking about people that say I love and people that I say I hate are more interesting and valuable to me than people that say I have no opinion, I don't care, I'm indifferent, you know, I have no feelings. Feelings are important. Even polarizing feelings are important, because there's always going to be 5% on either side that absolutely love and absolutely hate. And Crocs, I think those Crocs shoes, I'm probably going to buy another pair on my way out. Something, even though I think Crocs are actually responsible for my plantar fasciitis, but that's another story for another day. But there's something about these goddamn ugly shoes that everybody loves. And maybe it's the campaign for real beauty. Maybe it's the fact that we all stare at mirrors now and realize that we're not as good looking as those models in GQ or Vogue magazine. But there's something very authentic about, you know, just being normal and imperfect. And I think what really happened, if I can just close on the idea of the no comment meme, but then also ask Seth his comments on the idea of embracing not hatred but passion, whether it's good, bad, or ugly is that, Seth, people care. And if they hadn't spoken up, then they just wouldn't have cared. And the fact that they did care, you know, deep down, I can tell you, speaking on behalf of myself, I care, and ultimately, I think here we are together. We may never have got this opportunity if a spark or something hadn't happened. And dust settles, people learn, people move on, as long as they keep moving. But it is about that latent, and sometimes not even latent, passions, that if we can explore them and exploit them, if we can agree to disagree, if we disagree even in general, that's fine. That's actually okay. So,
well, there's a whole bunch of things you're bringing up at once. So let me try to touch on them as briefly but succinctly as possible. Fashion isn't any different than it was 100 years ago. If you want to be in the fashion business, you have to expect that some people aren't going to like your new fashion. I think that's very different than putting a positive spin on the lack of civility that is embracing our culture over the last 10 or 20 or 30 years. And I think consumers are about to get a comeuppance, that when you scream and yell because it took 30 seconds to get your hamburger instead of 40 seconds, or when it's totally unacceptable that there's Hunt's ketchup instead of Heinz ketchup at McDonald's, no one listens to you anymore. And that there is plenty of examples online where bloggers have raised the temperature of discourse so high, it's irrelevant now. It's like talk radio. Talk radio doesn't change anybody's mind. No one. It doesn't influence public policy. It may galvanize voters, but it doesn't influence the conversation, because everyone on talk radio is screaming. And I think that there's a tendency among bloggers to use the word deserve. Apple deserves me to respond this way because they asked for it, because that's what their brand is. No, they don't deserve it. The fact is that any time you can take down the temperature and increase the intellectual, thoughtful content of your feedback, you're going to get a better response. I mean, I don't know if you got kids in your house, but if you have kids in your house, all you have to do is watch what happens to a six-year-old with a tantrum versus a six-year-old who asks an intelligent question. Parents get really good at ignoring the six-year-old with a tantrum really fast. And we can't keep throwing tantrums online and expect that marketers are going to listen to us, because they're just going to shut you out. And so I think, yes, you need to be remarkable if you want to be noticed. You need to be noticed if you want someone to listen to your story. And sometimes when you get noticed, you're going to have people who don't like you. But that's different than embracing this idea that you got to get people to actually hate what you're doing. Because I don't think it's necessary, and I think the hatred spills over and makes the person who loves you feel bad and maybe back off on the story. So I'm not sure I want to go that close to the edge. I don't think most marketers should.
It's very interesting, because we're going to move into winners and losers, and I'm not sure, Seth being the smart guy that he is, originally I had a different winner and loser, and he was going to come and his winner was going to be my loser, and my loser is going to be and the other way around. But I've actually changed that as well, and it's funny, you know, I've learned a lot, and I'm growing too as a blogger and part of the conversation. I've taken a very different position with the way that I've blogged and now about to podcast about the winner and the loser. I looked at the 75 odd comments on AdRants. And that's another thing, by the way. 75 comments is hardly a conversation. that's a book. Very hard to get through those. So, you know, let's get into the winner and loser and talk a little bit about, you know, bringing everything that we've discussed home.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so here's the thing. Both my winner and my loser is going to be agency.com for their so-called viral video that they uploaded to YouTube, and probably as of this morning had about 20,000 views on YouTube. For those of you that have been living under and comfortably maybe under a rock, agency.com were asked to pitch on the Subway account. They were also asked to prepare a video about the agency, how they thought, you know, their culture, their passions, their their thinking, etc., and submit it. They decided that their idea would be to kind of create a video of making the video, so to speak, and demonstrating how they took this idea and basically uploaded it to YouTube and actually demonstrate, I guess, that they understood the medium, but also that they could create a viral video. What has ensued is a storm in a teacup, maybe a little bit of that bleeding edge hatred that Seth was talking about. AdRance has certainly slated the move. There were, you know, probably close to 100 comments maybe by the end of today. I spoke to a reporter about it from one of the mainstream trades yesterday, and I said to them, here's my take. If they win the business, it was an act of genius. If they lose the business, it was an act of idiocy. And he said, come on, it can't be that binary. It can't be that black and white. And I said, well, maybe it should be. Maybe we should actually reserve judgment and give them the benefit of the doubt and actually see whether, in fact, their ability to take a risk and differentiate themselves by their own words, demonstrating how they think, in fact, pays off or doesn't pay off. And that's why I'm making them my winner and my loser with a little asterisk, because I want to see what happens. And maybe I'm being unfair by putting so much pressure on them to win or lose the business based on just a little viral video and YouTube. But I think maybe that's a little fairer than passing judgment and calling them, you know, names, you know, and saying that these guys are X or they're Y or they're Z. So I'll comment on a little bit more, but I wanted to throw it over to Seth and see if he had any thoughts on it.
Well, I'll give you my thoughts and I'll give you my winner and loser. I think that they won with a small W because we're talking about it. They lost with a bigger L because it's lame. I mean, they used the opportunity, but they didn't put their best foot forward. I kept waiting for the punchline. I kept waiting for it to be interesting. The only thing that's interesting about it is that we're talking about it. And so I was a little disappointed there, but I don't think either the winner or the loser rises to the level of discussion, and I wouldn't have brought it up. You did. My winner and loser are the Dixie Chicks as a winner. Great review of them today in the New York Times. Dixie Chicks rejected the fundamentalist orthodoxy of country music, stood up with lyrics they weren't supposed to have, music they weren't supposed to have, and most important, a speech with a political point of view they weren't supposed to have, and got completely thrown out of the conventional marketing of their music. And as a result, only became the single best-selling female musical act currently working today, I believe, and only got the right to make whatever music they wanted. That they're a winner because instead of just doing what they were told and being yet a number on a list of 40, they're the only one. They're the one that stood up and carved their own path, which they couldn't have done 20 years ago because the channels didn't exist. If you lived in Nashville or Virginia, you couldn't have heard the Dixie Chicks 15 years ago because there wasn't one station that would have played them. But now, because the channels are different, they win. And my loser is every organization, every company, and every individual that didn't have the guts to do something cool yesterday. That it's so easy to single out someone who tried and then say you're a loser for trying, and I refuse to do that. Instead, what I'm saying is I'm singling out all the people who didn't try. All the folks at their job who didn't threaten to quit if their boss wouldn't let them do something. All the job seekers who insisted on having their resume on vellum paper in Times New Roman font. All the nonprofits who want to raise money tomorrow the same way they raised money yesterday, because otherwise they might offend someone on the board. All those people whose names I don't know because they didn't stand up, they're the losers, and they're going to be the ones who are going to be suffering 6 months from now, not agency.com.
Speaking of which, it's interesting, though, I mean, that you gave him a small W in terms of winner but a big L in terms of loser, because I think, you know, and you said that, but I think the point is they could have done so much more. Arguably, though, the only reason we're talking about them and the fact that they got 20,000 views is the fact that the content was so lame. Well, if they did, in fact, do it on purpose, and by the way, guys, Tom Agello, I know him well and I like him. There's a little bit of spin for you, my friend. Go ahead and tell a story. Go demonstrate that marketers are liars. because you have an opportunity there, and I think you do need to kind of go to the old corporate communication well. The lameness of it, and by the way, the only reason that it actually got the viral pickup, Seth, is because, and I can, we all know this, that every member of that company viewed it and then sent it to 50 of their friends and said, please view it. It was kind of the old renter crowd. But anyway, we're still talking about it now. And I do have to come back to your loser to say, you know what? They did take a chance. They did do something different. They did take a risk. They should never be punished, for that. But sometimes it's not what you do that's the crime. It's what you didn't do. That is the pity, I should say. As far as your winner, and also, by the way, you talk about not taking chances and doing things differently. The American Cancer Association just raised $40,000 in Second Life by actually going and fundraising in Second Life. So, you know, you do things and you deviate from the path, you know, that everybody else is going down. You will stand out and you will be remarkable. As far as the Dixie Chicks are concerned, my only thought on that is, it's not just authenticity, it's actually conviction. It's having a point of view and sticking by it, you know, and believing and having confidence and self-confidence maybe and being self-assured. And it's something we need to see from brands. That little girl is self-assured, no doubt. So here we are. I think we may have made a little bit of a tactical flaw by choosing the food court so close to midday. But Seth, thank you for giving an hour of your valuable time and being a part of this, and you know, you can come back anytime, although we won't do it in a cage at the food court in the Westchester Mall. Thanks, Seth.
Thank you for having me, Joseph. We were debating how many people make it to the end of the podcast. So here's the deal. First five people to email me their mailing address, if you live in the continental United States, I can promise this. If you don't, my publisher has to agree. We'll get a free copy of the new book, Small is the New Big. So go ahead and send email to SethGodin@yahoo.com, or you can just find me on my blog. There's a link right there. First five people to send me their mailing address, I'll send you a new copy of the book. Thanks for listening. Thanks for having me.
And Seth, I hope you'll also just indicate how many emails in total you get, because that'll be a nice proxy. Okay, he'll tell me and I'll tell you. So thanks everybody for listening. I hope you're still listening at this point, and I will see you next episode of Across the Sound.
I reserve the right to revisit.
You've been listening to Across the Sound with Joseph Jaffe. For more juice, check out www.jaffejuice.com.
You've got to be very, very courageous and maybe a little bit crazy.